To be part of this service, what I said was, people have to understand where we stand, and we can't change what we stand to win people, particularly when God has said it. We hope that people come around to our way of thinking, which we believe is the biblical way of thinking. If, however, they don't and they still want to fight, they're going to have to fight someone else someplace else. Something like that. I can remember when I was a kid, and I've shared this before, but my sister was really picking. And, you know, my sister was 8 years older than I was, and in that period of dating, and it was a three-bedroom, two-bath ranch, and she and I had to share a bath, which had a shower in it, and we would fight in the morning. I learned to go in there and turn the hot water heater off, you know, and freeze her out of the shower and those kinds of things. But I remember us fighting once, and she said some very unkind things to me, and I said some very unkind things back to her. And Mom heard us and really went after me, which I thought was entirely unfair. And I said, Mom, first of all, she started it. Secondly, she said as mean of things to me as I did to her. And Mom said, I understand that. I know that. But when you say it, it hurts. And thought about that. Sometimes some of you have the gift of saying it and it hurts. And maybe I say things that I have more of a bite than I intended to have. I'll put it that way. I want to read to you from Matthew chapter 5, verse 21 through 26. And this is a breaking in to what is known as the Sermon on the Mount. And Jesus is talking about what it means to have holiness in your heart, which was vital to people who wanted to follow Him. And in following Him, obey the fullness of the law that He had given, that had come from God in the Old Testament. And so, let me read to you verse 21 through 26, and I'd like to just meditate on these passages with you for a couple of minutes. Actually, that's a lie. It'll be a little more than a couple of minutes. Verse 21, you've heard it said, you've heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be in danger of the judgment. But I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whoever says to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. But whoever says, you fool, shall be in danger of hellfire. Therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go your way. First be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your gift. Agree with your adversary quickly while you are on the way with him, lest your adversary deliver you to the judge, and the judge hand you over to the officer, and you will be thrown into prison. Assuredly, I say to you, you will by no means get out of there till you have paid the last penny. Now, early in the Lord's, or the Sermon on the Mount that begins here in Matthew chapter 5, Jesus is talking about what it means to be kingdom people. He's talking about what His law is. I think it's fair to say that His expression is the fullness of the Mosaic law. Perhaps not directly to the letter, but what the law of Moses at least came or dealt with in principle, Jesus was dealing with in the spirit, or He was getting to the core of the law of Moses in this Sermon on the Mount. And the thesis of the Sermon on the Mount, most scholars would hold, would be the previous verse, which is verse 20, which reads, For I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. Now, the scribes and the Pharisees were people who practiced the Mosaic law to the letter. In fact, again, a lot of the teaching that Moses or that Jesus had in which he encountered the Pharisees had to do with the fact that the Pharisees had gone in some ways by the letter far beyond the law of Moses. In other words, Moses had given the law and the Pharisees had said, well, Moses hadn't been clear enough. Let's minutely examine each law. And it was said that among the Pharisees that they had devised a law for every possible situation you could find yourself in, so that no behavior in any situation was ever at question in regards to what you should do. And so when Jesus looks at then these people and says, listen, unless you're more righteous than the Pharisees, you can't be in my kingdom. You can't be a disciple of mine. You can't get into the kingdom of heaven unless you're more righteous than the Pharisees. He's saying something that I think to that audience was very shocking, because the Pharisees were held up as sort of the epitome, as the example of what it meant to be righteous, among others, including themselves. And so that was common, a common understanding in the Judean area. So when he says, you see the most righteous people over there? If you're not more righteous than they are, you're not going to get into the kingdom of heaven. You can understand how staggering that statement was, and how then Jesus no doubt feels a need to explain himself. As Desi would say to Lucy, explain himself, you know. I've got to say something about this, because I've just said something that has taken their breath away. And of course, what Jesus then does in the next 28 verses is he has those six statements where he says, you have heard it said, but I say to you. And in each of these statements, he says, now you've heard the Pharisees and scribes say this, and they're true, but actually they're not getting to the depth of the issue. They're talking about things in many ways surfacely or even hypocritically, but you and I need to live the law and get at the law in the heart of its matter. And so he explains himself in verses 21 through 26. This is the first of the six times. Again, he'll say, you've heard it said, but I say to you. And in this passage, he sets up three things the Pharisees say, but then he comes and says, but they're very hypocritical, or they're very shallow in the application of what the Old Testament law or what the Bible is actually saying. Verse 21 and 22, he says, for you have heard it said to those of old, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be in danger of judgment. But I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. I love how Jesus says that. Every smart preacher starts with everybody else's sins, you know. Everybody likes to hear everybody talk about every other people's sins, not themselves. So he says, let's take murder. I take it, all of you probably don't have many murders in the crowd. You've heard it said it's wrong to kill or murder somebody. Now, in the Old Testament, it wasn't wrong to take a life if it was in self-defense, if it was in defense of the nation. It wasn't wrong to take a life as capital punishment. In the Old Testament law, there was capital punishment for crimes. But there was nothing preventing you from self-defense. There was nothing preventing you from being a soldier and going to the battlefield and in the course of those duties as a soldier to take lives. What was at issue was, of course, what we would call murder. That is, taking a life in a non-defensive way, particularly for your own good. And yet, Jesus is saying, the Pharisees would say that it's wrong to murder, but I'm saying that it's also wrong to be angry with a person without a cause. And in God's eyes, that's murder too. Now, it's important to understand maybe what Jesus is getting at here when he talks about being angry without a cause, because it's known that in the Greek language, the Greek language was richer than ours, and it's known by most people that there were multiple words, Greek words for like our word of love. And so when you see love in the Bible, it could mean, the Greek language may mean the love of God. It could mean brotherly love. It could mean the love between a husband and a wife. It could mean other kinds of general kind of love. And that was also true of anger. There were two major words for anger among the Greeks. One was thumos. And thumos was hot-blooded anger. Thumos was the kind of anger that flames up inside of you. Thumos anger, was the kind of anger that you feel in traffic. Kind of anger you feel when somebody bumps your elbow and spills coffee all over you and you got a meeting in 5 minutes. It's the kind of anger you feel when you come home and your kid's done something stupid. They've used crayons to decorate the wall, you know, freshly painted. It's thumos. It's hot. It goes up, but it also comes down pretty quickly as well. But there was also orgo anger. And orgo anger was the kind that was a slow-burning anger. It's the kind that burned deep. It's the kind that was there and it broods. The King James would often translate the orgo anger as wrath. And wrath, you know, in English has the same root word as wreath. Wrath makes you like a wreath. A wreath is that thing we'll be hanging on our doors that's twisted. It's a twisted ornament in a circle you hang on your door. It's a wreath. And wrath is that thing that both words are from the word wraith, which is ghost, which is another something you don't care much about, but there's all the combination there. But wrath is the twisting of the soul as a wreath is twisted, so you're all knotted up inside and it stays forever. It's not the hot burning kind, and that's wrong too. There's list of sins in the Bible that makes it too. But Jesus is talking here about that deep burning anger, that wrath that gets nursed. Forget who said it. You're the English person. Who said the coward dies 1,000 deaths, the brave person only dies once? Like that. Yeah. Might have been Hemingway or Nolka. I don't know who it was. I'm just guessing at this point. But the point is that a coward, every day is a death. Every day they back down is a coward. A brave man only dies once, a coward dies 1,000 times. There's a way in which a murderer kills once, but a wrathful person kills every day, kills 1,000 times. And in the Bible, motive matters. God knows if you would do it, if you could get away with it without penalty. And what Jesus seems to be saying is that when people wrong you and you nurse it, and it won't go away, and it's twisted your heart up, every day you get up thinking about what they did. You see them. It might even have some thumos. You might have some burning anger inside of you, plus the orgo, plus the wrath. Jesus is saying that in God's eyes, is the same as murder, because you would do it if you could get away with it. And in a sense, a person with wrath, again, kills them 1,000 times. Guy who murders only did it once, but you wake up every morning and in your mind, you're killing them. Again, it's the motive that counts. Jesus will talk later how if you look upon a woman to lust after her, that's adultery. Again, there's some things that get in your eyesight that there's nothing you can do about, but if you look to lust, only reason I'm here is to look, to lust. See, that's a funny thing. Let me just chase this a minute. See, when we come to the judgment in heaven, or the judgment's not in heaven, it's on earth, but when we come to the judgment, there are going to be a lot of people charged with things they never did. There are going to be people up there before God, and they're going to be judged as serial killers and adulterers, and they didn't do anything. But they would have if they could have got away with it. In the eyes of God, God knows. On the other hand, I think there are people who are going to be applauded at the judgment as great missionaries, and they never went to be missionaries. It was in their heart to go, but they kept having babies or something. It's like, I would have gone, but nobody would take me. I ended up with a debilitating illness that confined me to a wheelchair. I never went, but the Lord knew your heart. This is one of the ways to theologically talk about or answer the question that sometimes people ask, what about all the people in the world who have never heard the gospel? All these people have never heard the gospel. What's going to happen to them at the judgment? And I would simply say this, and I can't give you a Bible verse for it, so this is opinion. But God knows who would and who wouldn't receive the gospel if they heard it. He knows who would and who wouldn't. It's in His power to distinguish the two. And again here, Jesus is saying to these people, you all think your hands are clean because you've never killed a person. But I say to you that if you hate them, and if you nurse that hate, in my opinion, you have essentially committed murder. Then he says in the next verses, he says, Pharisees say murder is about essentially the hand, but I would say it's about the hand and the heart. Then he says here in verse 22, verse 22, but I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment, and whoever says to his brother Raca shall be in danger of the council, but whoever says you fool shall be in danger of hellfire. So again, the Pharisees talked about murder, but they also talked about language. And for the Pharisee, offensive language was about vulgarity. But Jesus says slander is also offensive, or gossip. He says among the Pharisees, they would say, you can't cuss. Can't murder. You can't cuss. If you say Raca in public, you'll end up before the council or before a judge. Raca was a four-letter word for them. It was a cuss word. And so if you cuss a person, that's wrong. And the Pharisees could see that cussing was wrong. But Jesus says, but if you call somebody a fool, you're also in danger of hellfire. Now, again, it's important to understand what Jesus is saying about being a fool. And we think of a fool as a person who's just stupid. But among the Jewish people, fool was synonymous with being wicked. In fact, look at the Psalm 14, verse 1 here. The fool has said in his heart, there's no God. They're corrupt. They've done abominable works. There is no one who does good. See here, he says a fool is a person who doesn't believe in God. They're corrupt. They commit abominations. Show the other verse, if you will. For the foolish person will speak foolishness, and his heart will work iniquity. To practice ungodliness, to err against the Lord, to keep the hungry unsatisfied, and he was caused to drink of the thirsty to fail. See, again, the fool just isn't somebody who does stupid stuff. They're an evil person. Look at the third verse here. This is David there with Abigail. Remember, Nabal wasn't going to give him the mini food, and Abigail, Nabal's wife, comes and pleads for her husband because David's about ready to have unholy fellowship with him. She says, please let not your Lord regard this scoundrel Nabal, which is a play on words because it literally means fool. For as his name is, so he is. Nabal is his name and folly is with him, but I, your maidservant, did not see the young men of the Lord whom you sent. What Nabal has done is evil. They're people that need to be fed. They're starving. And Nabal refuses them food. In fact, later Abigail will say he's evil, but don't treat him as Belial or the devil. He's a devil, but don't treat him like a devil. He's Nabal. He's a fool. He's a wicked person. And so then what is Jesus saying? He's saying, well, the Pharisees believe that the limitation of language is don't cuss. I'm saying if you go around slandering people, calling people evil that aren't evil, questioning motives that are pure, you are also in danger of the fire of God. Again, you don't have to be in the church circles very long. Maybe you do, because this is a good church. But let me back up. Given my vast experience in the church, growing up in a parsonage, I think Jesus is being very relevant here. Because I think there are a lot of religious people who would get very uptight if you said a four-letter word in public. And they should. Swearing is wrong. There are a lot of people who would get very uptight if you said a slang word in public. I don't think you ought to use slang. But at the same time, they don't have a problem going home on Sunday afternoon questioning the motives of lots of people at church. Can you believe they said that? What would they think? That they don't have a problem with having the church for dinner, although they would never think about uttering a swear word. I remember a guy once, and he disliked his pastor intently, and he shared his dislike of his pastor to everybody in his circle, and I was sort of in his circle, and it was just a matter of time before he got to me. So he's talking about his pastor, and he catches you off guard, you know, and he said, I don't know if you heard about our pastor. He's a horrible pastor, terrible guy, never visits, never does any of this thing. And can you believe the bumper sticker on his car? He's got a bumper sticker on his car that says, drive faster, I've got to pee. Can you believe that? I wouldn't have a bumper sticker on my car that said drive faster because I got to pee because I drive a Lexus. I don't think pastors probably should. It's probably not something you'd want on your car. Nothing wrong with it. It's just not something you put on a car. You're a pastor. But the point is that this man was saying, deeply offended, can you believe that he would put that word on his car as he stands there slandering the pastor? I mean, that's what Jesus is getting at here. He's saying, he knew the Pharisees well. You guys take offense at words and you think, as long as I don't say these particular words, I'm clean before God. No. If you call people evil, and we don't call them evil, we question their motives. Well, you know why they did that. They just did that to be seen. Well, you don't know that. Well, you know what they're doing. They're showing favoritism. You take what they're doing and you attach a less than honorable motive to it. And in that way, you're saying they could be a fool. They're not as pure as they look. Now, there's a place in 1 Corinthians chapter 13 where Paul is talking about what love looks like. And in his characteristics of love, I think there are 12 to 14 characteristics there. He says, and love thinks no evil. When you love a person, you don't think that what they're doing is evil. You don't ascribe poor motives to what they're doing. Love doesn't do that. See, when I do something that you might question, this is what I want you to do. If it looks questionable, I want you to say, I know Leisure. I'm sure he had a good reason. I'm sure his heart was in the right place. Maybe he just forgot. That's what I want you to do. I don't even want you to question my motives, even if it looks like I might have done something that I shouldn't have done or forgot to do something I should have done. I want you to give me all the grace and say, I'm sure his heart was in the right place. Well, that's what love does. Love doesn't think evil. Love looks at people and say, well, they didn't get over to me today. They were probably busy, you know. They said they were going to call, they didn't call. I bet they forgot. He said that and it came across a little rough, but I bet he had a lousy morning. He has four kids, you know. He doesn't wake up in a good mood every day. I mean, you know. Love looks at the situation and spins it to the best possible motive. That's what Paul's saying. Love doesn't start off thinking evil. Love starts off thinking, it didn't look right, it didn't sound right, but I bet there's a good reason for it. That's what Paul's saying love does. And when we love people, that's what we do for them. But again, Jesus is saying, you need to understand what righteousness is. It's just not about saying the right words. It also has to do with what you say about people behind their back. That's a major thing that God cares about. And then third, verse 23 through 24, the Pharisees thought that it was important to be right with God. Jesus said it's also equally important to be right with your fellow man. Therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar and therefore remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go your way. First, be reconciled with your brother, and then come and offer your gift. And then Jesus drives home the importance of our desire to be reconciled with our brother in verse 25 and 26. He says, agree with your adversary quickly while you are on the way with him, lest your adversary deliver you to the judge and the judge hand you over to the officer and you be thrown into prison. Assuredly, I say to you, you will by no means get out of there till you have paid the last penny. Again, Pharisees would have said, I haven't murdered anybody. A lot of people I don't like, but I haven't murdered anybody. Jesus says that's not good enough. Pharisees would have said, I don't say cuss words, and I don't say slang words. And Jesus says that's not good enough. It still matters how you talk about other people, how you talk about their intentions. Pharisees would have said, what matters is I'm right with God. God knows my heart. Jesus said, no, it's also important to be right with your fellow man. Pharisees aren't going deep enough. And again, to drive that home, he talks in verse 25 and 26 about a citizen's arrest. Can't use that word without thinking about Barney and Gomer, but he talks about citizen's arrest. In the Hebrew culture, a citizen's arrest wasn't uncommon. You didn't have a police force like we do. You wouldn't just call the cops if somebody did something wrong. If you were physically able, if somebody stiffed you on a bill, they owed you some money, and they didn't pay you what you thought you were owed, the first thing you would do, again, if you were bigger than they were, is you'd take them, you'd get them up, you'd march them down the road to see the judge, and you'd both stand before the judge, you'd make your case, and the judge would make a ruling there. Again, citizen arrests weren't all that uncommon. That was the way things were done. Again, if you weren't big enough, maybe you'd take two or three friends and say, hey, I know what you did, and it was wrong, and on top of that, it's illegal. You're coming with us. We're going down to see the judge. Jesus says, if you're smart, if that happens to you, and even if you're the one who feels wronged, I think that's the implication here as well. The smart person tries to work out a remedy on the road before you get to the judge. Because the problem with ending up before a judge is that he might be in a really bad mood today. And the judge can throw you into prison or he can send you into slavery. So you don't want to catch a judge in a bad mood. And there's also the possibility that the judge won't rule on your behalf, he'll actually rule on the other guy's behalf. So actually, you don't want it to go to the judge. What you want is to make peace on the road before you get to the judge, because once it gets to the judge, anything can happen. It's out of your hands at that point. And you and I know, even in our own legal system, that, you know, you can think you've got a good case before the judge, and the judge doesn't see it that way. I mean, you can say, well, this person didn't pay me everything that they owed me for the job, and it ends up before the judge, and the judge says, no, you were paid well for everything you did. I don't think you were stiffed at all. Or you may say, I've got great grounds for divorce. I'm going to get everything he has. He's only going to be left with a fish cooler. And you get before the judge, and the judge doesn't see it quite like you see it. They see that you're at fault as much as he's at fault in the judge's opinion. Or you may say, oh, they're a terrible parent. We're going to go before a judge, and I'm going to get complete custody of the kids, and this is a slam dunk. Yeah, you may think that, but if you go before the judge, he may look at you and say, I think you're the parent here that I'm worried about the most. You don't know what's going to happen, when you get to the judge. There's a big X factor when you get there. So if you're smart, fix the problem before you get to the judge. Settle out of court if you can. Jesus is looking at you and I, and you see the implication. I have a problem with you. You have a problem with me. Don't say, well, I'm right, they're wrong, and we'll let all this hang, and when we get to the judgment, God will see it my way. Jesus is saying, don't you be so sure. Fix it before you go to the final judgment, if you can, because you don't know what's going to happen at the final judgment. You have a God who sees motive, He sees heart, He sees the intent, and you may say, in fact, I remember a guy telling me once, he said, I had a real problem with a guy, and he said, I admit it, I was at fault to a great degree. I think he was more at fault, but we were both at fault. And he said, I was praying and I felt convicted, and the Lord said to me, why don't you go reconcile with him? So I went and knocked on his door and I said, you know, my brother, we need to fix this. There's tension between us. We need to fix this. And he looked at me and said, what you did to me, I can't forgive. We'll just have to deal with it at the judgment. As Jesus is saying, don't you do that. Don't do that. Because see, you know as well as I know, I can be wrong about a person. I have been wrong about people. And if somebody would have said, boy, do you have a case before God? I would have said, yeah. This case becomes before God. I'll win it. I look back now and it's like, no, I wouldn't have. I misjudged them. And I wasn't as right in my heart as I thought I was at the moment. You can misjudge people's motives. You can be hard about the things that they've been through. In fact, I remember this illustration. I remembered it this afternoon of the, and it's just a story, it's just an illustration. But maybe it's not a story. I'll have to find out. I got homework this week. This prostitute ended up before a judge on charges of prostitution. And somehow in the prosecution of that crime, it came out that the young girl's dad had, or the young girl's mother had died, and that she was raised primarily by her father from a very young age. And the father had no interest in her at all. He was very busy or consumed with life. And he would let her just play outside and roam the neighborhood. And it was in a, you know, urban city, and so he let her be raised on the streets because he didn't have time for it. Being raised on the streets, she fell into a lifestyle of ill repute. And after the judge heard this, he said, well, listen, we're trying the wrong person here. Let's go find the father who didn't have time for this kid and let her be raised on the streets. You don't know where God's going to come down on it. We may be saying, well, it's a slam dunk case. Look at this kid. And he's saying, go find the father. He's as guilty as she is. You don't know how God will view these things. So Jesus is saying, fix the problems before you get to the judgment. Don't self-righteously presume that the issues that I have had with people, I'm right, they're wrong, God understands it, I'm sure He's on my side. Don't assume that. Now, there are difficult people to be around. I mean, I live with redheads, I get it, you know. There's difficult people to be around. And even Paul said, as much as lieth in you, as much as you have, and sometimes you don't have enough. That's the way it is. But as much as lieth in you, much as lieth in you, be at peace with other people. I just want to drive this home here in the last 60 seconds. Because sometimes we go too far the other way. Now let me remind you, thou shalt not murder. The Pharisees were right. But don't hate either. Don't be vulgar. Don't cuss. Control your language. I mean, every aspect of life has been given restrictions. There's sexual boundaries in the Bible. There are things that you can't eat and drink. There's issues of how much to work. There's issues related to how much you can desire and covet something without it being sin. There are boundaries to what you can say in the Bible. Don't let vulgarity come out of your mouth. But don't speak ill of people either, particularly if you don't know. And the chances are you don't know everything. It's important not to cuss. It's equally important not to slander and gossip about people. And it's important to be right with God. The Pharisees are right about that. But we're also called to be right with those who bear His image, our brothers and sisters. In fact, I'll leave you with this. The most, and I think I've used this before, one of the most powerful illustrations in the Bible about this is in James chapter 3, which is just an incredibly, I mean, if you ever feel righteous and you say, you know, I got to deal with some of my self-righteousness, go read James chapter 3, it'll fix it. But James presents an issue there where he says you can't curse the image without reflecting essentially how you feel about the person. And he's essentially what he's saying is if you go to see a king and you say in the throne room, you're the greatest king in the world. I love you, king. There's no king like you. You walk out of the throne room and you see a picture of the king on the wall and you spit on the picture. That brings into question all the nice things you said about the king when you were worshiping him. What James is saying is if you and I, if people bear the image of God, then you can't worship God while spitting on the image of God without bringing into question whether your worship is sincere. It's a powerful, humbling issue that James brings up. It's important, again, to be right with God. It's equally, I wouldn't say equally important, but it's almost equally important to be right with our fellow men as much as lieth in us. Again, the Bible here is getting at the issue of what holiness is. What holiness is. Purity, righteousness, right motives. Stand with me.